enforced. In Griswold, however, the state was prosecuting a doctor and the director of Planned Parenthood who were openly violating the law. By 1965, the idea that government could prohibit all contraception seemed contrary to the values of many Americans. The Constitution, however, nowhere explicitly protects the right to contraception. The justices all knew their constitutional history and recognized that if they invalidated the Connecticut law to vindicate such a right, they might be accused of Lochnerizing. Nevertheless, a majority of the justices voted to strike down the Connecticut statute. But though they agreed that the law banning contraception was unconstitutional, they disagreed as to why. Justice Douglas, a committed New Dealer who had been appointed by FDR, wrote the majority opinion for the court. Douglas hated Lochner, and presumably for that reason, felt that he couldn't rely on substantive due process to invalidate the Connecticut law. But he also hated the Connecticut law, believing that it interfered with the intimate relations between husband and wife and with their physician's role in that aspect of their marriage. Instead of relying on substantive due process, Justice Douglas found that the Connecticut law infringed on a married couple's privacy. The Constitution nowhere promises a general right to privacy, but Justice Douglas believed that the right to privacy could be found in penumbras of the Bill of Rights. What's a penumbra? It's a shadowy, indefinite, marginal area surrounding something. Justice Douglas's argument was that various provisions in the Bill of Rights create zones of privacy. The First Amendment, for example, protects, among other things, a right to free assembly. The Third Amendment protects against the quartering of soldiers in one's house. The Fourth Amendment protects against unreasonable searches and seizures. And the Fifth Amendment allows one to refuse to give self-incriminating evidence. Justice Douglas conceded that none of these rights squarely apply to the issue at hand, the right of married couples to use contraception. But he argued that the sum of these rights added up to something more than their individual parts. Collectively, these provisions added up to a broader right to marital privacy than the individual clauses protected. Now, it's not clear that Justice Douglas's penumbras approach is any less judicially aggressive than arriving at the same outcome via substantive due process. But Lochner was so anti-canonical, that is, it was so widely seen as wrong, that Justice Douglas wanted to steer clear of its doctrinal reasoning, even if his solution might not have been any better. Other justices concurred in Justice Douglas's outcome, but would have relied on different doctrinal avenues to get there. Justice Goldberg agreed that the Connecticut statute was unconstitutional, but he relied primarily on the Ninth Amendment. As we've discussed, the original Constitution of 1787 had not included many rights, in part because some of the founders, including James Madison, were concerned that listing some rights would imply that other rights that were not listed were unprotected. The Ninth Amendment seems to address that concern. It essentially tells us that just because a right is not listed specifically in the Constitution does not mean that that right does not exist. The problem, of course, is that the Ninth Amendment doesn't tell us how a court should go about figuring out whether a particular unenumerated right is in fact protected by the Constitution. A constitutional right is a powerful thing. It essentially limits the legislature's power. In other words, a constitutional right empowers an unelected federal judge in some circumstances to invalidate the act of an elected legislative body if that act unduly invades the right at issue. Judges, therefore, must be cautious in announcing new rights that are nowhere mentioned in the Constitution. Perhaps for this reason, judges usually stay away from invoking the Ninth Amendment. Justice Goldberg's use of it in Griswold is probably the most famous citation of that amendment in our nation's history. Notice that judges invoking substantive due process face the same challenge. Even if we accept that the Due Process Clause does protect some unenumerated rights, how do we really know which ones? Justice Harlan's concurrence tries to answer this question. Justice Harlan, whose grandfather, incidentally, had served on the court and dissented in Lochner, thought the statute banning contraception did violate the liberty component of the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause. And unlike Justice Douglas, he thought that a judge could invoke substantive due process without resuscitating Lochner. Specifically, Justice Harlan thought that substantive due process contained a limiting principle that would prevent judges from using it whenever they wanted to strike down a law that offended their own personal values. Harlan thought that the doctrine, properly understood, relied upon respect for the teachings of history. Based on this history, judges could decide whether a challenge law offended basic values that underlie our society and that are implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. In other words, Justice Harlan, drawing on some earlier cases, thought that judges should look to see whether our society has historically considered a particular liberty interest to be fundamental. Given the importance of marriage in our society, married couples deserve this protection against unjustifiable invasions of their privacy. Justice Harlan's concurrence is a noble attempt to try to cabin substantive due process, to recognize that the Constitution does protect some rights nowhere listed in the text, while simultaneously trying to limit those rights so that judges can't just rely on their own value judgments to decide which rights deserve constitutional protection. Critics, however, can fairly charge Justice Harlan with making his own value choice. By saying that the Due Process Clause only protects rights historically considered fundamental, Harlan necessarily prioritized traditionalist values over newer ones. Of course, not all newly asserted rights are worthy of protection, but Justice Harlan's approach would seemingly deny constitutional protection to rights that many today would deem fundamental on the ground that past generations did not. It's worth noting that not all the justices agreed with the outcome of the case. Justices Black and Stewart in dissent concluded that the Constitution nowhere protects the right of privacy. If people in Connecticut don't like the contraception law, they need to persuade the legislature to change it. One final doctrinal point. Though Griswold protected a marital right to contraception, a later case, Eisenstadt v. Baird, relied on equal protection norms to extend that right to unmarried people. It's not so uncommon for the court to decide a narrow issue, such as the right to contraception for married couples, and later to broaden its holding so that it applies more widely. Griswold marked the reemergence of substantive due process doctrine. Though Justice Douglas's penumbras argument won the most votes from his fellow justices, the court in later cases seemed to heed Justice Harlan's words that substantive due process was not all bad. The court has not been consistent in how it goes about applying the doctrine or in following Justice Harlan's admonition that the judiciary look to history as a guide. But as we shall see in the next lecture, after Griswold, the court turned to the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause in other controversial rights cases. Before we turn to those cases, though, consider a question about the doctrine more generally. A significant majority of scholars today believe that Griswold was correctly decided, but that Lochner was wrong. Why? If it was wrong for the court to read into the Constitution a liberty of contract to strike down a democratically enacted law in Lochner, then why is it any better for the court to create a right to privacy in order to strike down a statute in Griswold? What neutral principles might justify that seeming discrepancy? There are several possible answers to this question, but as you might expect, people disagree about how convincing they are. One possible answer is about institutional competence. Under this line of thinking, judges, who lack economic policymaking expertise, are more institutionally suited to rule on the invasion of privacy than on economic regulations. A related explanation posits that the rights at issue in Griswold are closer to one's personal identity than those in Lochner. The Connecticut contraception ban affected reproduction and sexuality, which for many people are closer to the core of their personhood than their right to bargain over employment terms. Yet another related argument is that Griswold involved multiple rights. The right to be left alone in one's home, the right to bodily autonomy, the right to make one's reproductive decisions, the right to marital intimacy. Whereas the New York Bake Shop Act was limited and only regulated one narrow aspect of just one industry's employment contracts. A final argument weighs the governmental interests at stake in the two cases against each other. The statute regulating the number of hours bakers can work in Lochner plausibly served a health and fairness interest. By contrast, many today have a hard time seeing what legitimate governmental purpose was served by the anti-contraception law. There are, therefore, ways to justify the common view that Griswold was right and Lochner is wrong. Most, however, require normative assumptions that not everyone would accept. And as we'll see, in the years after Griswold, debates over substantive due process would only become more complex and more heated.
The legal information provided in these lectures is for informational purposes only and not for the purpose of providing legal advice. You should contact an attorney to obtain advice with respect to any particular legal issue or problem. Lecture 7, Liberty Disputed, Abortion and Gay Rights.
Eight years after the court revived substantive due process by striking down a Connecticut statute banning contraception in Griswold v. Connecticut, it confronted a far more controversial issue, abortion. In fact, Roe v. Wade may be the most controversial Supreme Court decision in our nation's history. Thousands of people were so exercised about it that they wrote Justice Hugo Black letters protesting the decision, even though he had died 2 years before the ruling. They might have gotten him mixed up with Justice Harry Blackmun, who wrote the majority opinion. Some court decisions are very controversial when they're handed down, but they eventually produce widespread consensus one way or another. But Roe v. Wade divided the country when it was decided in 1973, and it continues to divide us today. As the legal scholar John Hart Ely put it, abortion is too much like contraception on the one hand and too much like infanticide on the other for us to agree how it should be treated. The problem is that there are no neutral judicial standards that can decide for us what abortion's true nature is. Accordingly, most people's views of Roe as a constitutional decision tend to turn on their views of abortion more generally. Like the general public, scholars agree on little about Roe v. Wade, except that the opinion is not among the court's finest. Even academics who agree with the court's decision question the supporting reasoning. Writing for the majority, Justice Blackmun began by rooting the decision in substantive due process, that is, in the liberty component of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. This liberty, he argued, includes the right to privacy, which encompasses a woman's decision about whether or not to terminate her pregnancy. Justice Blackmun noted the various detriments women might face if forced to carry through with a pregnancy they did not want. Pregnant women might face medical harm, and unwanted maternity could cause further psychological and physical harm. For these reasons, he found the state's authority to regulate or prohibit abortion is not absolute. However, Justice Blackmun also made clear that a woman's right to abortion is not absolute. To the contrary, he noted that the state may assert its interest in protecting the health of the mother and in protecting potential life. To decide when a woman's right to an abortion trumped the state's interest, Justice Blackmun developed a trimester approach. In the first trimester of pregnancy, the first 3 months, the abortion decision is left up to a woman in consultation with her doctor. In the second trimester, the state may regulate abortion procedures in a way that is reasonably related to maternal health. In the third trimester, the state may regulate or even prohibit abortions. Not all the justices agreed. Justice White, in dissent, wrote that abortion policy should be left to the people in each state, not judges. Presumably, some states would choose to permit abortions, but others would not. That's the very point of democracy and of our federalist system. We leave important decisions to the people's elected representatives, and we permit each state to decide those matters itself. According to Justice White, Roe offended these values both because it displaced democratic decisions on an important question of public policy and because it prevented each state from coming up with its own abortion policy. Justice Rehnquist, in his own dissent, reasoned similarly, arguing that courts should apply rational basis review when reviewing abortion regulations. In other words, they should only ask if laws regulating or prohibiting abortions are rational, a very deferential form of review that accepts legislative decisions in most circumstances. In addition to the criticism it generated, Roe created a fierce political backlash. In fact, some scholars argue that abortion lacked much political salience in the years before Roe. It was the court's decision in Roe, they say, that galvanized the pro-life movement and thrust abortion into the center of a national culture war that continues to this day. In any case, after Roe, abortion became a prominent issue in many elections, including presidential elections. This may seem odd since presidents rarely have direct input on abortion policies, most of which are created by state governments. But of course, one way in which presidents do affect the law of abortion is through their appointment of federal judges, especially justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. Abortion opponents, who are often but not always otherwise conservative, started fighting hard to get justices on the court who would overturn Roe. People who favored a woman's right to choose, who were often but not always otherwise liberal, began working to get justices who would uphold the decision. In some circles, abortion became a litmus test for whether a particular judicial candidate was acceptable. 19 years after Roe, in 1992, the Supreme Court confronted a new abortion case, Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania v. Casey. The case considered a Pennsylvania law that placed some restrictions on access to abortion, but the Solicitor General of President George H.W. Bush's administration filed a brief arguing that the court should use the case to overrule Roe. There was good reason to think that the court would do just this. In the nearly 20 years since Roe, Republican presidents had appointed 6 consecutive justices. President Ford had appointed Justice John Paul Stevens. President Reagan had appointed Justices Sandra Day O'Connor, Antonin Scalia, and Anthony Kennedy, and President Bush had appointed Justices David Souter and Clarence Thomas. Nevertheless, though Republican appointees dominated the court by 1992, the court in Casey upheld Roe by a narrow 5-4 vote. In fact, 4 of the 6 post-Roe Republican appointees voted to do so. Perhaps most galling to anti-abortion activists, the majority opinion was co-authored by 3 Reagan or Bush appointees, Justices O'Connor, Kennedy, and Souter. Casey made clear just how high the stakes were for Supreme Court appointments. Justice Blackmun, a Nixon appointee who, as you will recall, wrote the majority opinion in Roe, made this point in an unusual concurrence. He pointed out that one vote was all that saved Roe and the right to abortion from being wiped away by the court. Over the following years and decades, abortion would become even more of a judicial litmus test for groups on both sides of the issue. So what was the basis for the court's opinion in Casey? It focused on the importance of stare decisis, legal speak for following judicial precedent. The court opened with a sentence, "Liberty finds no refuge in a jurisprudence of doubt." To have true liberty, the court indicated, people need to know what their rights are. And for people to know what their rights are, courts need to interpret and apply the law consistently. Roe might or might not have been right when it was decided, but it had been an important part of the legal and cultural fabric of the country for nearly 2 decades. People had counted on Roe, organizing their intimate relationships and making choices in reliance on the availability of abortion should contraception fail. If the court were to overturn Roe, it would pull the rug out from under people's expectations. The resulting legal uncertainty would weaken the court's legitimacy. Of course, the court acknowledged, as it had to, that the court sometimes does overturn constitutional precedent. As we've already seen, the court eventually abandoned the Lochner precedent in the 1930s with cases like West Coast Hotel. And as we'll see soon, Brown v. Board of Education effectively overruled a policy of separate but equal facilities for whites and African Americans that it had established in Plessy v. Ferguson. But in both these cases, the court now explained, the court recognized that its earlier decisions had rested on false factual assumptions. The court in Casey explained that Lochner rested on false factual assumptions about the capacity of a mostly unregulated free market economy to satisfy minimal levels of human welfare. And Plessy rested on the false factual assumption that separate facilities could be equal. By contrast, the Casey majority argued, nothing had undermined the factual underpinnings of Roe. Of course, many people objected to Roe as a moral matter, but that's different from the false factual assumptions that prompted the judicial shifts away from Lochner and Plessy. It's not clear that the court's explanation here is so convincing. In dissent, Chief Justice Rehnquist argued that the court abandoned Lochner and Plessy not because factual understandings had changed, but because the country's values had. The country abandoned the laissez-faire capitalist philosophy that animated Lochner because people began to believe it didn't do enough to protect workers and because completely unregulated markets are historically too vulnerable to sudden collapse. Even more to the point, the country abandoned Plessy's rule of separate but equal because it decided that segregation was racist and morally wrong. What had changed in West Coast Hotel and Brown then was not so much our view of the facts, but our values. The Chief Justice, therefore, was unconvinced by the majority's efforts to distinguish prior departures from precedent. Interestingly, though Casey relied heavily on the importance of following precedent in its decision to uphold Roe, it nevertheless departed from Roe in some very important respects. First, whereas Roe seemed to tether the right to abortion to privacy, Casey seemed to root the right instead more in a conception of decisional autonomy. The court indicated that the real problem with laws banning abortion is that they interfere with women's ability to make very important, deeply personal life decisions relating to procreation and child rearing. Casey also emphasized an equality component that had been less central in the opinion in Roe. The right to abortion impacts the liberty of women. The ability of women to participate fully in the social and economic life of the nation depends on women's ability to control their own reproductive lives. Women also have to bear the pain, anxieties, and physical constraints of pregnancy and childbirth. Accordingly, the majority reasoned that the Constitution limits states' power to pass regulations that intrude on women's autonomy and personhood in these ways. Casey also abandoned Roe's trimester framework and articulated a new legal test. Under Casey, states may not impose an undue burden on a woman's right to seek an abortion before viability, that is, before the baby can survive outside the mother's uterus. In applying this framework to the Pennsylvania statute at issue, the justices upheld some provisions and struck down others. For instance, it upheld a 24-hour waiting period that required a woman to wait a day after she consults with a physician about the nature of the abortion procedure before actually having the abortion. Though this provision would prevent some women from getting abortions, the court concluded that this was not an undue burden. By contrast, the court struck down a spousal notification provision in the Pennsylvania law that had required married women to receive their husband's consent before obtaining an abortion. The court here found that the provision imposed an undue burden because some women who want an abortion fear abuse from their husbands. In this way, the court in Casey, like the court in Roe, tried to strike something of a compromise. Under both cases, states do not have complete authority to regulate abortion procedures. However, under both cases, the court will uphold statutory restrictions that do not overly burden the right to abortion. Of course, this kind of middle ground position satisfied almost no one. Pro-life groups were outraged that the court protected the right to abortion so that states could not outlaw abortions altogether, and pro-choice groups weren't happy that the court upheld some regulations that made it more difficult to get abortions, such as the 24-hour waiting period. Whatever one thinks about abortion and whether the Constitution protects it, Casey is a fascinating if problematic opinion. On the one hand, Casey's focus on decisional autonomy and equality for women seems to be a sounder basis for a right to abortion than the privacy rationale articulated by Roe. If there should be a right to abortion, decisional autonomy and women's equality seem to be more at the heart of the matter than privacy. To this extent, Casey seems to be more analytically rigorous than Roe. On the other hand, Casey's heavy reliance on stare decisis is problematic. First, as we've already discussed, the court follows its own precedent, except for when it doesn't. And even if we accept the precedent rationale, Casey itself seems to abandon precedent in some ways. For one, the court insisted on following Roe, but then switched the rationale underlying the decision. Why should we think it's so important to follow an earlier case if we think that case's reasoning unworthy? Moreover, in upholding the 24-hour waiting period in Casey, the court also abandoned some other post-Roe cases that had invalidated 24-hour waiting periods. If precedent were really so important, shouldn't those decisions have militated in favor of striking down Pennsylvania's waiting period? These are serious critiques of the court's reasoning, but there's a legitimate counter to these attacks. Judicial precedent is important, this argument goes, not in its doctrinal particulars, but in the broad message it sends to society at large. The rationale underlying Roe v. Wade probably mattered less than the right to abortion generally. To ordinary people living their lives, it doesn't really matter so much if the right to abortion is rooted in notions of privacy or decisional autonomy. What matters is that the right exists, and by upholding Roe, the court maintained that societal stability. Relatedly, regulatory requirements like the mandatory 24-hour waiting period really exist more at the margins of the abortion right. Such a waiting period does burden some women, but for consistency's sake, what matters more is the core right to abortion. Of course, Casey's critics, and there were many, did not find this defense convincing. Starting with Chief Justice Rehnquist in dissent, they highlighted the internal tensions in the court's opinion. Most importantly, they emphasized that abortion involves the purposeful termination of potential life. These critics argued that Casey, like Roe, had shortchanged the state's interest in protecting human fetuses and had inadequately justified taking away its authority to do so. The court has decided other abortion cases since Casey and has sometimes upheld abortion regulations and sometimes struck them down. But so far, as of this taping, the court has not overruled Roe and Casey's core holding that the Constitution protects a woman's right to abortion. Whether that holding endures as the composition of the court continues to change remains to be seen. Abortion is probably the most controversial area of substantive due process doctrine, but it's not the only one. Some of the most important gay rights cases in recent years have also implicated the doctrine. As I'll explain, these cases also involve some equal protection norms, but the cases were primarily rooted in substantive due process. The 2003 case of Lawrence v. Texas involved a Texas law that criminalized same-sex sodomy, that is, homosexual anal or oral sex. In 1986, the court had upheld a similar Georgia law in a case called Bowers v. Hardwick. In a 5-4 decision, the court in Bowers had decided that the Constitution does not confer a fundamental right upon homosexuals to engage in sodomy, Indeed, the court noted that far from being a traditional liberty, same-sex sodomy has historically been prohibited. 17 years later, the same issue returned to the court in Lawrence. The law of substantive due process had changed little in the intervening years, but the country had changed a lot. Whereas many Americans were deeply uncomfortable with homosexuality in 1986, by 2003, many realized that they had gay friends or family. Though some Americans still believed in the rule from Bowers, by 2003, the idea of making gay sex a crime seemed antiquated to many. Relying again on the liberty component of the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause, the court overruled Bowers and emphasized from the start that the court in that case had framed the issue way too narrowly. Whereas Bowers had defined the issue as the right to engage in homosexual sodomy, Justice Anthony Kennedy's majority opinion in Lawrence said that the case was about liberty from unwanted governmental intrusion into the private home. To frame the case as just about the right to engage in a certain sexual act, Justice Kennedy explained, was to misunderstand that the government ought not interfere in a person's intimate relations with a loved one. Additionally, the court emphasized the harmful effects of the Texas law. The law branded gays and lesbians as presumptive criminals, making it much more difficult for them to be treated like other members of society. Indeed, a conviction for violating the sodomy statute would restrict a person's ability to enter into a variety of professions, such as medicine, athletic training, and even interior design. The Lawrence court also disputed the Bowers court's view that the country had historically criminalized gay sodomy. Justice Kennedy pointed out that early anti-sodomy laws were not directed specifically at homosexual conduct, but at all non-procreative sex. Laws targeting same-sex couples specifically did not develop until the last third of the 20th century. Moreover, sodomy laws were generally not enforced against consenting adults acting in private. But even if the nation had criminalized gay sodomy in the past, Justice Kennedy seemed to indicate that this ought not matter so much because times have changed. Our culture and other cultures elsewhere in the world have become aware that liberty should include substantial protection of adults' private, consensual sexual behavior. In other words, the court seemed to be indicating that changed values should inform the content of the Constitution. In addition to these arguments rooted in liberty, the court also drew on the language of equality. Laws targeting gay sodomy, but not straight sodomy, were born of animosity toward gays and lesbians, and therefore are an invitation to subject homosexual persons to discrimination both in the public and the private sphere. Equal protection law frowns upon such animus. Though the majority opinion in Lawrence was primarily rooted in notions of liberty and the language of substantive due process, the opinion is perhaps best understood as being a hybrid decision, blending together liberty and equality norms. This is important in understanding that cases don't always fit neatly into pre-existing doctrinal categories. Judicial doctrine and law school casebooks typically group 14th Amendment cases as liberty cases or as equality cases. But as Stanford law professor Pam Carlin has pointed out, liberty and equality have a stereoscopic relationship, reinforcing each other. Though the majority opinion in Lawrence did not fully explain exactly how liberty and equality interact, the message was clear that the liberty right was even stronger because the offending law also revealed a bare dislike of a group that has, at least until recent years, been unpopular. It's important to note that three justices dissented in Lawrence. Justice Thomas, in a short dissent, stated that he thought the Texas sodomy law was a silly law, but that the Constitution does not forbid states from passing silly laws. The court, he argued, should not substitute its judgment for the legislature's. In a longer and angrier dissent, Justice Scalia argued that the majority's opinion signaled the end of all legislation based on community morality. Scalia argued that the logical end of the majority's opinion was that laws prohibiting bigamy, adult incest, prostitution, and same-sex marriage would all fall. On that final point, Justice Scalia's dissent proved to be prophetic. Indeed, it seems almost incredible how quickly the legalization of same-sex marriage came to pass. In the early 1970s, a pair of male gay student activists at the University of Minnesota applied for a marriage license in Minneapolis. The clerk denied the request on the grounds that Minnesota law limited marriage to opposite-sex couples. In the litigation that ensued, the Minnesota Supreme Court rejected the argument that this limitation was unconstitutional. The case, Baker v. Nelson, then went to the U.S. Supreme Court, which in 1972 dismissed the appeal for want of a substantial federal question. The court's dismissal indicated pretty clearly that the justices considered frivolous the argument that the U.S. Constitution protected the right to same-sex marriage, given that 14 years later the court upheld Georgia's sodomy ban in Bowers. The court's attitude in Baker seems hardly surprising. By the early 21st century, however, public opinion on same-sex marriage was rapidly shifting, just as it had shifted on gay sexuality generally. In 2003, the same year the Supreme Court decided Lawrence v. Texas, Massachusetts's highest state court ruled that a Massachusetts law limiting marriage to opposite-sex couples violated the Massachusetts Constitution. Same-sex marriages in Massachusetts began the following year. Other states soon followed Massachusetts. By the time the issue reached the U.S. Supreme Court in 2015 in Obergefell v. Hodges, about 70% of the states, containing roughly 70% of the U.S. population, had legal same-sex marriage. Admittedly, in many of these states, federal or state courts invalidated existing same-sex marriage bans. But some other states adopted same-sex marriage by statute or voter initiative, and public opinion polls showed support for gay marriage was rising quickly. Against this backdrop, the court ruled by a 5-4 vote in Obergefell that same-sex marriage bans are unconstitutional. States, therefore, must permit same-sex couples to marry. Justice Kennedy wrote the majority opinion, as he had in Lawrence, and he focused in large part on the importance of marriage in our society. The right to personal choice regarding marriage, he said, is inherent in the concept of individual autonomy. Marriage is one of the most personal decisions a person can make, so this is the kind of decision that people should be able to make without having to worry about state prohibitions. Additionally, marriage protects the children raised by married couples, and the legal benefits of marriage help children understand the integrity and closeness of their family. Marriage is also simply a keystone of our social order. Society indeed offers lots of benefits to married couples, such as favorable inheritance laws, property laws, evidentiary privileges, and so on. Justice Kennedy's point isn't entirely explicated, but it seems to be that because marriage is so central to people's lives and to society generally, the government simply cannot just exclude a certain class of people from it without at least a very good reason. Like Lawrence, Obergefell relied primarily on the language of liberty, but it also worked in a fair amount of equality language. The problem with same-sex marriage bans is not only that they deny an important liberty, but that they discriminate against a class of people without good enough reason. Indeed, the states had failed to proffer a persuasive reason in favor of same-sex marriage bans. As in Lawrence, the dissenting justice's primary argument was that this issue isn't for the courts to decide. Same-sex marriage might or might not be good policy, but it should be up to state legislatures, not federal courts, to grant it. Chief Justice Roberts likened the majority opinion to Lochner, as it invalidated a democratically enacted law in support of a right lacking any textual hook in the Constitution. The Chief Justice, in fact, concluded his dissent by asserting that the majority's decision had nothing to do with the Constitution. The Chief Justice's point here seems overstated insofar as the majority opinion drew on constitutional norms that can be traced to earlier opinions, albeit controversial ones. But the Chief Justice was correct in one very important respect. For an issue like same-sex marriage, it's often very difficult for people to separate their own personal norms from their view of the constitutional issue. Here's what I mean. If you think same-sex couples are the same in most important respects as opposite-sex couples, then state same-sex marriage bans are almost certainly unconstitutional. After all, if a same-sex couple is in most important respects the same as an opposite-sex couple, then the state deprivation of marriage to same-sex couples clearly infringes on those couples' liberty and equality without a good reason. By contrast, if you think same-sex relationships are fundamentally different from opposite-sex relationships, then you likely think that the bans are perfectly constitutional. Law, by its very nature, must draw distinctions. So distinctions on their own surely cannot doom a statute. If same-sex and opposite-sex couples are very different, then of course the state can treat those couples differently under the law. The difficulty, similar to the one created by abortion, is that there are no neutral judicial standards to help judges decide whether same-sex couples are the same as opposite-sex couples in most important respects or not. Some psychological studies in recent years have amassed evidence demonstrating that same-sex couples and opposite-sex couples are in fact the same or similar in most important respects. In the interest of full disclosure, when I was in private practice, I represented the American Psychological Association in summarizing this scholarship to courts in cases involving the rights of same-sex couples. But though we hoped our briefs would make a difference, there's no law that requires a judge to accept these findings. A justice's preconceptions about gay marriage, then, what Judge Richard Posner calls a judge's priors, will go a long way to determining how he or she views the constitutional issue. The legal recognition of same-sex marriage has been a blessing to many couples who have gained the option to marry if they choose. But the saga also shines important light on how constitutional change occurs. The court does not consider constitutional issues in a vacuum. Although its decisions take the form of legal arguments, they are rarely too far ahead or too far behind the nation's collective views on a particular issue. When the court decided Bowers in 1986, most Americans were uncomfortable with gay rights. By the time it decided Obergefell in 2015, polls showed that a majority of Americans actually favored same-sex marriage. For better or worse, cultural norms help shape constitutional law. An important question, of course, is whether and how trends in public opinion should shape constitutional law. On the one hand, if the court did not take into account changing national attitudes, it would run the risk of undermining its own legitimacy. If the court were to fall too far behind or get too far ahead of public opinion, people might be disinclined to respect its decisions. On the other hand, constitutional law must consist of more than just the sum of recent opinion polls. It can't be that the Constitution's meaning changes simply because a slim majority of Americans have changed their mind about something. While the court appears to have resolved the issue of same-sex marriage with finality, the larger question about how constitutional culture informs constitutional law will endure long into the future.
The legal information provided in these lectures is for informational purposes only and not for the purpose of providing legal advice. You should contact an attorney to obtain advice with respect to any particular legal issue or problem. Lecture 8, Equal Protection and Civil Rights.
The 14th Amendment, which, as we've seen, was ratified shortly after the Civil War in 1868, forbids any state from depriving a person within its jurisdiction of the equal protection of the laws. For nearly a century, however, the Equal Protection Clause fell miserably short of its lofty goals. For a brief moment during the post-war period in the South known as Reconstruction, There were reasons to be hopeful that the newly freed slaves might gain political rights and relative economic independence. Some African Americans ran for political office and won important positions. 16 blacks sat in Congress during Reconstruction, and many more held important positions in several southern state governments, including briefly the governorship of Louisiana. Of course, compared to their percentage of the electorate, blacks were woefully underrepresented. However, as the Columbia historian Eric Foner puts it in his great book on Reconstruction, considering slavery had just ended in 1865, the fact that well over 600 blacks served as legislators was a stunning departure from the norm of American politics. Sadly, those modest advances quickly disappeared. African Americans still faced terrible racism throughout the country, and as the 1870s progressed, white Southern Democrats began finding ways to systematically exclude African Americans from elections, even though the 15th Amendment stipulates that the right to vote shall not be limited on account of race or former condition as a slave. Simultaneously, the Ku Klux Klan and other white supremacist groups emerged to try to reestablish white control over the former slaves. The Klan used brutal violence to try to impose racial subordination on blacks, murdering many, especially those who had achieved a measure of political or economic success. The federal government, which had tried to reinforce Reconstruction during its early years, began turning a blind eye to white Southerners' abuses. A variety of issues, including economic problems in the mid-1870s and a surge of Northern racism, sapped the North's resolve to continue to work to protect African Americans. The Supreme Court, too, did little to help African Americans against the terrible human rights abuses they were suffering. For example, as we saw in Lecture 5, in the 1883 civil rights cases, the court invalidated a congressional statutory provision that had forbidden places of public accommodation, such as hotels, theaters, and railroads, from denying services to African Americans. Congress had passed the law partially pursuant to its authority to enforce the 14th Amendment, but the court held that because the Equal Protection Clause only forbade states from denying persons the equal protection of the laws, it did not support a statute that forbade private entities from discriminating on the basis of race. This was a plausible legal conclusion, but it was hardly the only plausible outcome. It certainly also would have been plausible for the court to have concluded that many places of public accommodation, like railroads and hotels, have duties to the public and in some cases receive licenses from state governments. To this extent, the court could have held that these entities do constitute state actors, or at least that Congress can choose to treat them as state actors to help guard against violations of equal protection. Turns out that the civil rights cases were part of a larger judicial pattern that interpreted the Reconstruction Amendments and the law more generally against African Americans. Perhaps the most famous example is the 1896 case, Plessy v. Ferguson. The court there sustained a Louisiana law that required separate but equal accommodations for black and white passengers on railroads. The law's challengers contended that separate accommodations were a badge of inferiority, but the court rejected that argument. Separate accommodations, it held, only implied inferiority if blacks themselves chose to give them that construction. In dissent, Justice Harlan argued that the law was unconstitutional because its purpose was to exclude blacks from white cars. "Our Constitution is colorblind," Harlan contended, "and neither knows nor tolerates classes among citizens. In respect of civil rights, all citizens are equal before the law." The civil rights cases in Plessy were hardly unique for the period. With few exceptions, the Supreme Court ruled against African Americans in a wide variety of cases involving such disparate issues as voting rights, criminal justice, and peonage practices that sought to re-enslave blacks in all but name. Most of these decisions sound morally reprehensible to our ears today, but they were consistent with the racist views of most white Americans at this point in American history. As the Harvard constitutional historian Michael Klarman argues, most judges at the time either shared these racist views or were unwilling to challenge the dominant opinions of the time. And those attitudes colored their interpretations of the Constitution. By the 1940s, the court's comfort with racial discrimination and segregation was beginning to crack, but only beginning. Racism was still widespread in the U.S. and extended to groups other than African Americans. In one of the most infamous episodes in American history, the U.S. military during World War II designed and enforced an order excluding all persons of Japanese ancestry from designated West Coast areas. The United States, of course, was at war with Japan, among other countries, and some military officials worried that Japanese spies might have infiltrated the Japanese-American population on the West Coast. The military claimed that it would be difficult to separate loyal Japanese-Americans from disloyal ones. So, citing military danger, it excluded all of them, forcing them to relocate to internment camps in other parts of the country. The conditions in these camps were often terrible, and when the war was over, many Japanese Americans found that they had lost property that they had been forced to abandon. Fred Korematsu was convicted of violating this military order and appealed the decision. Mr. Korematsu lived near San Francisco and wanted to remain in the Bay Area with his girlfriend, who was not of Japanese descent. In 1944, in Korematsu v. United States, the court upheld Korematsu's conviction and the constitutionality of the exclusion order. The majority opinion emphasized that the court owed great deference to the military, especially in times of war. The country was embroiled in a terrifying worldwide conflict, and to many Americans, the threat seemed real. Given the dangers and exigencies of war, the majority of justices did not want to second-guess military decision-making. In dissent, Justice Murphy argued that the order was simply plain old racism, and that it was not at all clear that it was reasonably related to an immediate, imminent, and impending public danger. Subsequent research, in fact, cast serious doubt on whether the order actually did anything to protect the country. Even though the court did uphold the exclusion order, the decision laid the groundwork for later cases that struck down racial discrimination. The majority opinion, written by Justice Hugo Black, stated that all legal restrictions which curtail the civil rights of a single racial group are immediately suspect. Courts must subject them to the most rigid scrutiny. Despite this assertion that the Constitution disfavors racial classifications, the court upheld the order here. Korematsu is thus a curious case. It stands for a crucial principle of American law, but as the Columbia scholar Jamal Green has said, it's also anti-canonical in that most scholars believe it was wrongly decided. Still, by asserting that racial classifications trigger the most rigid scrutiny, Korematsu laid the groundwork for later equal protection decisions that protected racial minorities against discrimination. The court foreshadowed these later decisions in a lesser-known companion case to Korematsu. In Ex parte Endo, the court held that the government could not continue to detain Ms. Endo, a Japanese-American citizen, whom the government conceded was loyal to the United States. Korematsu demonstrates that the court was willing to defer to the military if the military said it couldn't tell whether someone was loyal or not. But if the government conceded that a citizen was loyal, Endo made clear that the military could not detain that person simply because she belonged to a particular racial or ethnic group. This was only a small victory for civil rights at the time, as most Japanese Americans had to endure the indignities and real suffering of the internment camps until the war's end. But Endo anticipated bigger legal changes on the horizon. By the end of World War II, the country was finally becoming a different place. And except for in the Deep South, open racism was no longer as acceptable as it had been. There were many reasons for these cultural changes. The horrors of the Holocaust opened many people's eyes to the evils of theories of racial superiority. Also during World War II, many African Americans migrated to the North to take jobs that helped supply the military war effort. While by no means free of conflict, this migration eventually led to greater social and economic racial integration and to increased importance of African Americans in the Democratic coalition in Northern American politics. Finally, as the historian Mary Dudziak has demonstrated, there was a growing concern that the racially segregated South was making the United States look bad internationally, playing right into the hands of Soviet propagandists. Their message was that communism was the superior social and economic political system. Segregation even caused the United States allies to doubt the country's commitment to democracy. Against this backdrop, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or NAACP, brought a series of cases to try to make Southern states live up to the requirement of separate but equal in various spheres, such as graduate school education. Instead of challenging Plessy's rule of separate but equal directly, these cases demonstrated that institutions created specifically for African Americans were not equal, and they succeeded. In Sweatt v. Painter, for example, the court declared unconstitutional the University of Texas Law School's policy of excluding blacks. Texas had defended its policy on the theory that it provided another state law school for African American students. The Supreme Court rejected this argument. The recently established black law school lacked the prestige, history, resources, faculty, and alumni base of the University of Texas Law School. Because it was unequal, Texas had to admit qualified African Americans to the state's flagship law school. In the early 1950s, civil rights attorneys attacked the constitutionality of segregation in K-12 public schools, and they decided to use the opportunity to challenge the legitimacy of Plessy's separate but equal rule itself. They brought cases in Kansas, South Carolina, Virginia, and Delaware, challenging those states' school segregation, and the U.S. Supreme Court consolidated the cases into one of the most famous cases of the 20th century, Brown v. Board of Education. As you probably know, the Supreme Court struck down the segregated school systems and ruled that separate is inherently unequal. But though the decision was unanimous, and though racial attitudes in the country were changing, Brown was still a difficult case for the court. For one, Plessy v. Ferguson was still binding precedent. Though many lawyers and legal scholars questioned whether that case had been rightly decided, it was hardly clear that Plessy had been the wrong interpretation of the original understanding of the Equal Protection Clause. The white men who wrote and ratified the 14th Amendment inhabited a very racist world that had only just ended slavery. It's pretty likely that a significant majority of them would have seen nothing wrong with sending white and black children to separate schools. Moreover, some of the justices on the Brown Court were New Dealers who believed that courts should be deferential to the political branches. Some scholars also thought that federal courts should be especially deferential to state policy choices in respect of the Constitution's federalism principles. On this view, just wasn't the judiciary's place to reverse the policy decisions of state legislatures, city councils, and school boards. Courts should only strike down public policy if it was blatantly unconstitutional. Additionally, the justices realized that the South would not take kindly to a judicial decision invalidating segregation. Many Southern whites felt strongly, very strongly, that their children should not go to school with black children. Even some more comparatively progressive Southern whites felt that so long as lynching and the most egregious forms of segregation ended, courts should not interfere to force integration in the public school system. Furthermore, as Professor Klarman points out, while whites deeply believed in segregation, it ranked lower on the priority list for most African Americans, who were much more concerned with issues like lynching, fairness in the criminal justice system, and voting rights. When Brown was first argued before the Supreme Court in 1952, the justices were deeply divided on the case. Unable to resolve the case, the court set the case for re-argument the following term. In the months in between, fate intervened. Chief Justice Fred Vinson died of a heart attack. President Dwight Eisenhower nominated Earl Warren, the former Republican governor of California, to replace Vinson as Chief Justice. Warren would prove instrumental, not just in voting to invalidate school segregation, but also in law.